Today.
Golf Today on Memorial Day Monday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch. We honor those who gave the ultimate sacrifice to our country. It's great to be with you, my friend. It's a busy time in the game. We got golf going on all over the globe.
It feels like that every week at this point in the season. There always seems to be meat on the bone every week, and certainly this week's no exception. The US Women's Open, the Memorial Tournament, Jack's Place, and of course we're leading into some NCAA golf this afternoon.
Yes, and Ben Griffin has entered the chat again to the highlights from yesterday. In case you missed it, Ben Griffin entered the day tied with Matty Schmidt on the par 5 first hole, aiming this for eagle.
This is making a statement pretty early that the nerves were not there. That from 15 feet. Takes a one-stroke lead.
Matty Schmidt now on the tee here at 5. This is part of the horrible horseshoe at Colonial, and this tee shot, relatively horrible, I would say.
Kind of horseshoe to the right. He was forced to take a drop, went on to make double bogey, dropped back to 11 under, and that was 5 back of Griffin by then.
But he wasn't done, and I like the fight back. Here he is, the par 3, 16th, trying to have his voice heard.
It's from 196. That is kicking range. Made that birdie, get back to 11 under. Griffin made bogey on that hole, dropped back to 12. The lead just won.
About 17, this from the bunker, his third. Oh, no.
It's a lousy lie, couldn't even aim for the pin. Made it to the rough, decided to chip it from there. That was another bogey, dropped back to 10.
Leaning on the short game. Now this is Ben Griffin leaning on his short game, choking down to the steel here at 18.
We've all been in that position, but not with this much on the line. That was a pretty good execution. He rolls it 4 feet past the hole.
How about Matty Schmidt's own short game prowess at 18? Really needs to hole this.
That's exactly what he does.
Oh.
Got him in the clubhouse at 11 under, put him in a bit of pressure on Griffin for that last putt.
4 feet for the win. A little left to right, bang, down it goes. He shoots 71 and win the tournament at 12 under. And now, that's his first win by himself. He gets the new car, that 92 Defender, the plaid coat. Has a new standing in the game as well. Let's take a look at the leaderboard. Can now call himself a two-time winner on the PGA Tour Zurich Classic with his buddy Andrew Novak last month, and all by himself Sunday at Colonial. And yesterday, he spoke about the journey to this moment.
Now I'm at the point where I feel like I'm starting to show that I am an elite golfer. I can compete against the best. It hasn't really sunk in quite yet here, like what necessarily I've accomplished at least the last few weeks, but I know that I'm extremely proud and extremely happy with the way my hard work's kind of paid off a little bit recently, because golf is not an easy game. It's a very hard game, and you don't win very often, and some people never win, and it's really cool to get that monkey off the back, going back a few weeks ago. And now I feel like, now that I've done it a couple times, I just feel super confident in my ability down the stretch. I know it didn't maybe look like it today, but, I felt really calm and confident over a lot of putts today. And I don't know if I necessarily would have felt that maybe a year ago. But I just feel like I'm in a really good place with my golf game. It's a cyclical game. I got to make sure I keep doing the right things to remember what I'm doing right now, continue to build, and continue into the summer with some big events upcoming.
I had a lot of key putts for par there on the last couple holes. Talk about keeping your composure when you kind of got in some tough situations.
Yeah, the scrambling is what put me in the seat here today. I'm very confident in my short game. I credit that going back to junior golf. My parents did so much for me growing up. They got hit hard by the recession. The 2008 recession. And so they invested a lot in me being able to practice and compete. I didn't spend very much money on range balls. I was at a public golf course, and I would chip and putt all day. I'd hit maybe a half bucket of balls for $5 or whatever it was. And my parents, you know, they always considered themselves middle to upper class, but I knew there for a little bit when we lost our house, when we lost everything. I know they sacrificed a lot for me. And I credit a lot of my, success down the stretch today to, my short game. It kept me in it, and that's what I did as a kid. That's what helped my short game be so good down the stretch today.
All right.
I didn't mean for that answer to get that emotional, yeah. But it kind of was.
Wow, how about that? A question about his short game leads to the memory of his parents losing their house during the recession in 2008, and the fact that he wouldn't buy range balls to hit. He would just chip them back and forth because it was less expensive. What a powerful moment.
It really was, and it's nice to see that he hasn't actually lost that perspective at all and realizes that he didn't get to where he is alone, because sometimes you do see athletes in a lot of sports act as though it was a one-man band to get to the top of the game, and it almost never is. And you can certainly see in Ben Griffin's story there the sacrifices that his family made to get him where he is today. It wasn't a silver spoon story at all. And he's not one of these country club kids who's just sort of out here with no sense of perspective in the world around him at all.
Yeah, and he's faced financial difficulties more than once. He mentioned the recession, but also he was a loan officer. He couldn't financially sustain a professional golf career, so he took a different job. He got some backers, was able to come back to professional golf, and look what he's been able to parlay that into now. Two wins in about a month's time on the PGA Tour in a completely different station in the game and a different level of confidence as well.
And the work ethic hasn't actually gone anywhere as well. We're only 21 weeks into this year, and Ben Griffin has made 18 starts on the PGA Tour. He's only taken 3 weeks off, a couple of wins, he's four top tens. He's also had four missed cuts in there, but he's definitely getting a little more consistent than he has been in years past. You know, in his first couple of years on tour, 23, 24, he had, you know, eight top tens over the course of those two seasons to keep himself in the mix. Now he's actually putting himself in contention. And the weird thing is, if you look down in terms of all of his shot length and strokes gained metrics, there is no huge weapon in Ben Griffin's arsenal. The big point is there is also no glaring weakness in Ben Griffin's arsenal. And when things are going well, as they did this week, you know, he's always good around the greens, but he was third in putting at Colonial as well. So when it's on song, Ben Griffin's probably going to play well enough tee to green to actually get himself into the mix. And I think that's what we saw. He's the perfect opportunistic player for this age, when he's not necessarily going to be spectacular, but he's going to be hard to shake off.
And I think you're right about the attitude and how similar he is day to day, week to week. Being out there, as I have been in 2025, and interviewing him a couple of times, and he was the guy trying to get into the Masters, trying to get into the top 50. Is he going to be the nearly man who just continues to come up short? And look how that narrative has changed and shifted. He's up to 13th in the U.S. Ryder Cup standings. I mean, listen, we got a lot of golf left between now and the fall at Bethpage Black, but he is entering a new realm. And to hear him talk about his confidence, you never know where his ceiling might be.
Or even financially, he's banked $5 million in prize money in the PGA Tour this year, so I don't think he's going to be heading back to that mortgage office job anytime soon. Let's take a look at the Comcast Business Tour Top 10, which rewards consistent and reliable play throughout the season. Here's how that Top 10 looks now. Scottie Scheffler on top, just ahead of Rory McIlroy, Sepp Straka. Ben Griffin moved up 16 spots all the way to number 5. In other news today, Will Zalatoris has announced that he underwent back surgery on Friday for two herniated discs and will be sidelined until at least the fall season. It's the second back surgery for Zalatoris, who missed more than 8 months of competition after a microdiscectomy back in April of 2023, I should say. This was Will's statement. This spring, I started feeling some discomfort and instability in my back that progressively got worse. Following the PGA Championship, an MRI showed that I had re-herniated two discs. After discussing the options with my medical team, I underwent surgery this past Friday with Dr. Michael Duffy at the Texas Back Institute. I'm happy to say that I woke up feeling good and excited about my long-term back health. Time to focus on my recovery and get back after. We certainly wish Will Zalatoris all the best. Always one of the most likable guys out there. And it's such a bummer at this point, because he was At the point where this back, it became an issue, he was really hitting his stride. He finished runner-up in three majors over the course of two seasons, the Masters in 21 and then in 22 at the PGA Championship and famously at that US Open at Brookline when Matt Fitzpatrick came out on top. Won his first PGA Tour event a month after that US Open, or 2 months later. Then the back hit him. The very next week, knocked him out of the FedEx Cup playoffs, and it seems to have been a struggle ever since.
Yeah, I spoke to a short game coach, Josh Gregory, right before the Masters tournament, kind of find out what was the state of his health, and Josh told me they're going back to his old golf swing, going his old DNA, but obviously the body wasn't able to sustain whatever work he'd been doing. I've often said Will reminds me of the guy who absolutely loves being a PGA Tour player. I said if there's two guys, it's Sahith Theegala and Will Zalatoris, who absolutely love their job. And I just feel for him because it's been a lot of start-stop for him. He's very close to being a major champ. He loves the difficult questions that tough majors and golf course asks him, but his body has not been able to sustain it. So you just have to wonder, what is the next step? Maybe this surgery does take enough of the pressure off his back and he's able to go about his business. But you know what it takes for these guys to be great. It's the work behind the scenes. It's the gym work. It's the range balls and the long sessions. Can he put together a formula of work enough that doesn't put his body at jeopardy?
And we see other guys take a different strategy to it. Daniel Berger was another guy whose back really knocked him out of the game for basically a year and a half. He's now back to playing good golf. There is a pathway back for guys, even young guys of Will Zalatoris' age. Will's only 28 years old now. There is a way back for these guys. It's not as though it becomes a chronic issue, and we saw over the years with, say, Freddie Couples, who became so debilitated by it over the years. I don't think Will Zalatoris is in that category at all. So much of this is going to be, how can he maintain the positivity and the outlook? Because he's going to have lost since 2023, or the end of second half of 2022, Will Zalatoris is probably going to have lost a year and a half, basically, of playing time, maybe closer to 2 years out of that time frame. That's a lot at this stage of his career, and it's a lot of frustration that's going to wear up. The scar tissue comes from the surgery, but the scar tissue from the neck up in terms of the frustration of where his career was and this kind of stall that he's been put into, that's going to be hard to get over as well, I think.
No, we wish him well. Will Zalatoris is one of the best ball strikers in the game today. And speaking of great ball strikers, Lucas Glover also can hit that rock. Also great, you know, behind the microphone. He's been great with us here on Golf Today. Also great on a Sirius XM radio show talking about the USGA testing of drivers on the PGA Tour, also at the PGA Championship. Hey, listen, most guys don't give them their real driver anyway. They give them their backup just in case, and the testing is the way it is. Why I know a lot of the guys, they keep two drivers in their bag just in case. Hey, oh yeah, it's this one. It's this one right here. Yeah, do this. Test this one. He continued to say, immediately I came to the realization that we're not all playing under the same umbrella at these majors unless we did test everybody. So we got live guys, we got other tour guys, we got tons of different players and tours being represented at the four biggest tournaments of the year. So why doesn't everybody get tested at every major? And why don't we somehow try to make sure it's the driver that is being used? And you know this, Eamon, the best players in the world know the difference between their gamer and the backup. If you're going to do it, his point, if you're going to test it, do it right.
And if you talk to enough equipment experts, they will tell you that if the driver does start to exceed the maximums and becomes non-conforming, it's not actually all that advantageous. And eventually, very quickly, starts to become disadvantageous in terms of the quality of the strike. But this is very much on the administrators of the game, whether it's in the major championships or on the week-to-week on the tour. Enough with the piecemeal posturing on this stuff. Either acknowledge that you are going to apply equipment standards or stop pretending, because that's ultimately where this game is these days. And there needs to be a robust standard that every player is matched to. You don't actually get to just randomly pick 30 guys out of a field, and you don't even know if it's their actual game or club that you're getting. That is simply posturing. That is not a robust process at all. And the game, frankly, ought to be embarrassed if that's the standard that they're holding these guys to.
Are you a little surprised that Lucas would say, hey, this happens. Hey, this is supposed to be a game of honesty and calling, you know, penalties on yourself. And he's basically saying, oh, there are guys that are working around the rules a little bit and saying, here's driver number two. I'm not giving you driver number
one. I'm not surprised Lucas would say it in the sense that Lucas is always sort of very upfront, flinty character. He never shirks away from any controversial topic at all. I'm not surprised guys would do that. I don't necessarily think it gets to the point of rule breaking here, because the players don't know if their game or driver is sort of violating any equipment standards or not. If they're not having it tested, they don't actually have that knowledge. They just simply are trying to avoid a situation where their gamer could be said to exceed the standards, and then they have to make a last minute change, which doesn't always work. We saw that with Rory McIlroy in Charlotte when he had to make a late change. Scotty Scheffler also had to make late change. It didn't seem to bother Scotty that much, though, admittedly. So I don't know that you can necessarily make the leap, and I don't think Lucas was making the leap of saying that this is intentional rule breaking. What it does is expose a standard of testing that is substandard for this level of the game, and it exposes guys who have figured out how to not kind of expose their own equipment to being potentially removed during a big week where there's a lot of money at stake. Right. And there's an easy way to fix that. Test everybody and test them seriously.
Especially in this era where the equipment is so...
Because it doesn't take that long critical. To test
it
these guys.
It doesn't. Put them all through the car wash, make sure it's all above board, and test everybody, especially on the eve of an important tournament like a major championship. Everybody's got to be playing from the same starting point.
We should live stream the testing as they all walk off the range. Well, the PGA of America was at the newly renovated Congressional Country Club last week for the Senior PGA Championship. Congressional will also host a KPMG Women's PGA, a PGA Championship and a Ryder Cup in the next dozen years. Sort of a remarkable story here on Cabrera. I mean, there's a lot to dislike given the charges on which he went to prison. The flip side of that is he was sentenced, he served his time, expressed remorse. What's remarkable to me at the moment is how he's actually found a game at 55, because that's when historically the downslide actually starts in senior golf.
Yeah, usually you get the hot start at age 50, you're the youngster out there and you get that pep in your step. To be, you know, 55 years of age, having spent 30 months in prison, speaks to the savant that Angel has always been inside the ropes. We're talking about someone who is this close to being a member of the World Golf Hall of Fame, a winner of the Masters, a winner of the U.S. Open, nearly won a second Masters, but for Adam Scott's
heroics. Only one stroke out of that famous playoff at Carnoustie in 99 as well. He could have been in that four-man playoff. He could be a four-time major champion.
Yeah, absolutely. But you're right. I mean, goodness, to start this year, back-to-back majors, and we've talked about it, you know, the fact that the seniors have this stretch of time of five majors in like 8 weeks. It's a very compressed schedule.
It's a good time to get hot, though.
A possibility for a player to be able to take advantage, but who would have thought Angel Cabrera would be that player?
Yeah, if it wasn't for the prison term and being out of the game, none of this would be a surprise. I mean, this guy's won 57 times around the world. He knows how to get it done. He's won on every tour at every level of the game, and he knows kind of this kind of hardscrabble approach to golf and fighting your way up from absolutely nothing. He's done that. His ability to do it in his 50s, after being out of the game for 2.5 years in prison, to me, it's just a remarkable story. But there's a feral intensity to how he goes about his game. He's always scrapping, and he's been scrapping from the Latin American tours, you know, when his first win, I think, was in 1991.
Yeah.
See, he's got a lot of experience in terms of getting the job done. Another guy who's got a lot of experience getting the job done walked away gutted from that one, Potter Harrington.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of the World Golf Hall of Fame, he is a member, of course, a three-time major champ. I was struck by how clear-eyed he was after his round on Sunday, and it's kind of a self-examination of what went wrong.
You know, I've a lifelong problem with getting confident and cocky, and I did in the 15 tee box, and it was such a simple tee shot, 5 wood, little draw down there, and I just totally didn't get into it enough, and then panicked at the last moment and hit a big hook, and it's always plagued me my whole life since I've been a kid. Just get overconfident and just don't. I'd be much better off if I got to the 15th hole and there was water everywhere. I probably would have done a better job. I just sometimes just, you know, it follows me around that I can get overconfident. If I could do what if I had the ability to do what I say, I'd be the best player in the world. but unfortunately I don't.
This is why we want players to stop, even when they lose. And in this discussion about players not doing media obligations, for me, if I was writing the game story, as I would have been back in the day, I mean, how, you know, clear-eyed and honest was Padraig about what he sees is a failing? This is one of the best players that we've had in the last 20, 30 years in this game, and saying, you know what, this is a blind spot that I have. I get a little cocky on the golf course. I relax just a little bit. He said if there's been more trouble on that hole, he would have been more locked in. I just appreciate that as a golf journalist and a golf fan, that he took some time to talk about what went wrong, knowing that he will bounce back.
And one thing that we see a lot in golf, and you see it in every sport, you saw it last week even with the Knicks in the playoffs as well, is that sometimes the side that is leaving with despair is a better story than the side that's leaving in ecstasy. And what we didn't see in that clip from Padraig is a little later, he was watching a monitor to the side as he continued the press conference, watching Cabrera play the 18th hole, which included him making a bogey, which gave him that one-shot margin because Padraig had missed a three-footer on the 18th hole. So he knew even then that was yet another gut punch. 15 wasn't really the real killer. It was 18, knowing that had he made that putt, well, then he was going to a playoff at that point. But you know, Padraig's, it's been a hard-won perspective. He has, because he won in his 10th start on the European Tour back in 1996. He famously called his mother up and told her the amount of the check in his first tournament and said, "Mom, they're giving the money away out here." And it only took him 10 starts to win. It took him a long time to win again after that. He's totaled 27 runner-up finishes on the European Tour in his career against the 15 wins. This now gives him 4 runner-up finishes in senior majors out there as well. So he's a guy who puts himself in the mix all the time because the drive to succeed, the searching never stops with Harrington. But he is also does have an ability, and it's been very useful to him over the course of his career, to kind of analyze it, cauterize it, and move on from it.
Who's been, you know, hitting more golf balls in their life than Padraig Harrington? Maybe Vijay Singh, maybe Gary Player. You? But we appreciate
how... He didn't say hit them well.
That's a good point. How expansive he is and how honest he is, even while gutted. And you're right. When I covered the NFL, I covered the San Francisco 49ers. You know, listen, I more enjoyed going into the locker room after a defeat as a sports writer just because the bandages are on the ground. There's a pall in the air. It just led to better writing. That's why golf, to me, golf writing is so powerful. When you have the Jean Vandevelde in 99, you have Phil in 06 at Wingfoot. I mean, Jeff Ogilvy walked away with the trophy, but more writers and more people were talking about what happened to Phil. And it's the agony and ecstasy of sports. And I'm sure it's not easy to talk. Phil talked after that Sunday
blow-up. Monty talked after that as well.
As well. And I think that makes the comeback story even better. Think about all those times Phil had to talk. 99, you know, the Pinehurst. 01, when David Toms got up and down at Atlanta Athletic Club in the PGA. Yeah. All the times Tiger beat him. That's what made 04 so great when he finally did win his first major.
And what made yesterday so interesting is that Padraig is by nature quite a reflective person. He spends a lot of time thinking about stuff. And Sunday before the PGA Championship, I had dinner with Padraig and Paul McGinley. Mm. And it's a beautiful mind at work that you're listening to at dinner. I mean, he's crazy. All of these guys are crazy. But Padraig's like the mad genius out there. But the searching and the thinking about every aspect of the game never stops. Mm. And it's very rare to get to the point where he is now, where he's 53 years old. And he loves this game every bit as much as he did the day he first started playing. Mm. Nothing has diluted with him at all. And that's why he's willing. I mean, he said something to me many years ago in an interview that struck me as odd coming from Padraig. He said that it's all about ego at the top level of the game. And I said, well, you don't strike me as a particularly egotistical person. And he said, if I didn't have an ego, I wouldn't put my head up there above the parapet to be chopped off every week just for the feeling of what it's like when it goes your way and you win. So Padraig's analysed the heartache that goes along with the ecstasy out there as well. He knows how to process this kind of stuff, and he takes a fairly unvarnished approach to this. Yeah, it's going to hurt him. Is it going to affect him this week? Probably not that much.
There's an old adage in sports writing, the smaller the ball, the better the writing, in part because we get to interview people like the three-time major champ, World Golf Hall of Fame member, Padraig Harrington. Of course, that wasn't the only golf tournament that happened this past week. Got the winners of the U.S. Amateur Four Ball. Will Hartman and Tyler Mawhinney took down some much more experienced players in New Jersey, and they will join us coming up. Welcome back to Golf Today. Last week at Plainfield Country Club, Donald Ross Design, Edison, New Jersey. It was a great week for a pair of young winners from the U.S. developmental team. And I tell you what, they did some work. I'm speaking of Tyler Mawhinney and Will Hartman. This is Mawhinney aiming, putting for birdie on the par 4 14th.
Around the lip and in, his partner went on to win the match 2-up. Sorry, go 2-up in the match, I should say.
And then Evan Beck putting for par on the par 4 17th. Needs this. Does not get it, so concedes the hole. Hartman and Mawhinney get the job done. And here's what they get, by the way, along with the customary USGA gold medal and custody of the four-ball trophy for an entire year. The pair received exemptions into the four-ball championship for the next decade, and they both also earned spots into the 2025 U.S. Junior Amateur held at Trinity Forest in Dallas, and the U.S. Amateur, which will be held at Olympic Club San Francisco. Will Hartman and Tyler Mawhinney join us now. Will, I'm going to start with you because I believe you're the elder of the two. You're 18, Tyler's 17. So, Will, how did you guys become a partnership? How did you guys get together in the first place?
I've known Tyler forever. I thought it'd be fun if we were to team up and do this, and we were lucky enough to qualify. And we just said, hey, let's go see if we can, how far we can go, and we had a great time, and we were lucky enough to win it.
Tyler, did you guys actually enter this tournament with serious expectations, or was it just kind of, let's go have fun and see how it turns out?
I mean, I think kind of both. I think we definitely knew we would have a chance to win if we played well, but I think we both went into it just looking to have as much fun as possible and hopefully play as much golf as we could.
Tyler, why do you think the partnership worked as well as it did?
I think, one, because we're really good friends and we can kind of feed off each other. And then if you want to go to more of the golf side of it, I think we're both really good ball strikers and iron players. And the two of us don't really make a lot of bogeys, so we kind of stay in holes and don't give shots away.
Not making bogeys is a good way to eventually make a living in this game. Will, you guys are both part of the U.S. National Team Program, which is pretty new. What have you guys gotten out of that program in terms of how you've developed as golfers?
Yeah, the USNDP has been great for me, and I'm sure that I can speak for Tyler and say that it's been great for him too. We've been given unlimited resources, and it's been great. You know, Coach Zambri and Coach Tiff have really taken us under their wings. They've given us some great drills, putting, short game irons, and it's only helped both of us. So I have to say that it definitely contributed towards our win.
Tyler, how about for you? Same question. I mean, we see Ludvig Åberg coming from Sweden, backed by this national program. How critical is it for the United States to put the funds and the coaching behind young players like you?
I think it's really important just to kind of help us like hone our skills and just kind of develop our game, not just base it off raw talent, and actually have some decision-making to help us with what we're doing.
Now, Will, the combined age of you two guys is 35. The combined age of your opponents in the final was 74. And I know the golf ball doesn't actually know how old you are, but in tough conditions, that kind of difference in experience can actually matter. What strategy did you guys take going into that final match?
I just think that we both kind of looked at each other on the first hole when it was pouring down rain and said, let's try and keep two balls and play the whole day. And I think we executed our strategy pretty well. There were maybe a few times where we had to rely on the one of us to get it done. But overall, I think we did a good job of just kind of trying to play our own game and not give shots away.
Will, Vanderbilt's out in La Costa competing in NCAAs. You're going there. I know Tyler's a verbal commit, anchored down. Scott Limbaugh, why, Will, Vanderbilt for you?
For me, ultimately, it was the coaches. Coach Limbaugh, I mean, he's a great guy. He really showed me on our visit what they like to do in their practice and how they get things done, and I was all a part of it. So it was kind of a no-brainer. I was looking at Florida and Alabama pretty hardly too, but there's no such thing as a bad decision. There are just some places where I felt like I fit in better, and Vanderbilt was certainly one of them. So I'm super excited to get things started in the fall.
Yeah, great golf program, great food as well in Nashville, yeah. Tennessee. Boys, congratulations. It's great to chat with you. I'm sure we'll be speaking again down the road. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
There they are, Will and Tyler. I'd say it's a household name. Getting it done at Plainfield in tough conditions. So much to look forward to.
This week brings us the second women's major championship of the season. Mount Saigo of Japan won the Chevron Championship a month ago. Now the world's best women head to Erin Hills in Wisconsin for the U.S. Women's Open. Our live from the U.S. Women's Open coverage starts tomorrow, 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Now, at the weekend, the LPGA Tour just wrapped the inaugural Mexico Riviera Maya Open at Mayakoba, which was won by 22-year-old rookie Chisato Iwai. In just her eighth event of the year, Iwai cruised to a six-shot win, which matches the largest win by a rookie since Nasa Hataoka back in 2018. And, of course, outside the ropes, the LPGA also made some news, named Craig Kesler as its commissioner after a six-month search. Kesler is the 10th commissioner in the tour's history and was most recently the chief operating officer of the PGA of America. Kesler talked with Matt Adams about his goals for the future.
I hope that in a handful of months, people look at the LPGA and they say to themselves, holy smokes, something magical is happening at that organization and I have to be a part of it. Whether it's aspiring athletes who want to play on tour one day, our existing partners, prospective partners, the more people believe in the future of this place, the better off we'll be. And Matt, to get there, there are four things that we'll be laser focused on. The first is around building trust, with our players, trust with our sponsors, trust with our fans. The second is around building visibility and making sure these players who leave it all on the course week in and week out are seen. The third is around building fans, because I'll tell you, there's a difference between watching the LPGA and rooting for the LPGA. And the more we can build fans, the brighter our future will be. And then finally, the fourth pillar is around building an even more solidified financial foundation for the future so that the next 75 years look even better than the last.
Well, here's a little more on Craig Kesler, the new LPGA Tour Commissioner, who officially stepped into that role July 15th, most recently COO of the PGA of America, was the CEO of Buff City Soap back earlier in his career, also a former Chief Operating Officer of Topgolf and a current member of the board of the National Golf Foundation. Well, Beth Ann Nichols joins us now, who is going to be part of our live from coverage at the US Women's Open. Beth Ann, thanks for your time. What's the initial reaction out there to Craig Kesler being hired as commissioner?
Well, I think players appreciate his passion for the game and for the tour. You know, I think he obviously has a very dynamic personality, and that comes across well for players. They want someone who's a good communicator, who can give them a clear vision of where, you know, he sees the tour, you know, not only in a year, but, you know, 5-10 years from now. I think, you know, they appreciate the fact that he comes from a golf background. They're really just getting to know his resume, but they know that, you know, he can pick up the phone and get things rolling in quick order. And I think that I know I certainly appreciated him saying that there wasn't time for a 100-day listening tour, and I think players feel the same.
You know, Beth Ann, he talked about building trust and building a fan base. What do you think the number one job is for Craig in your mind?
That's a great question. I definitely think that, you know, transparency is so important for players, for fans, for everyone to know, you know, where he's trying to take the tour. But I think visibility is so important. He has to have buy-in from everyone here. And so he has to have players willing to say yes to what he wants to do. And I think he has to figure out a way to get more eyeballs on the LPGA. And I'm interested to hear his plan for that.
We just heard Craig tell Matt Adams about his pillars for for the tour, and one of which was the financial footing of the organisation. It's no secret, Bethan, that the LPGA Tour doesn't have a lot of resources. It's very close to running on fumes in golf terms. Is how successful can he be in that situation? Does Craig Kesler need to coax or nudge or bully the other organisations in golf, chiefly the PGA Tour, into sharing some kind of resources?
Well, I think it wouldn't hurt. I definitely think the PGA Tour could do more in that way and should do more in that way. And I think the fact that he already has existing relationships with so many people who are movers and shakers in the golf industry should hopefully go a long way into making things happen, because it seems like these are obvious bridges that Mike Wann started. Obviously, we're seeing the fruits of that in the major championships. But it's felt for several years now like, you know, well, what else can be done? Surely there's more here.
He has suggested that he's open to a conversation with the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, which is a bit of a delicate balance to align a women's sports league with an authoritarian government with a pretty poor record on women's rights. If there is that kind of conversation, do you think he would meet any kind of internal opposition to that from the players, or are the players very much like a lot of PGA Tour players have been and just say, where's the money?
The latter definitely is for the most part what I've been hearing for years out here. You know, I think the vast majority of players are most interested in the bottom line. And I've honestly only had a couple of players I could count on one hand raise too much of an issue with quite frankly, where the money comes from. So, you know, I think that when Craig Kesler says he's going to talk to everyone, I take him at his word, and I think his players want him to do that.
Well, Bethan, I want to turn our attention to this week. This is the fifth time a USGA event has been held at Erin Hills. We've covered a lot of great championships together through the years. What's the buzz like in Erin, Wisconsin? Is the town going crazy? Is it a little bit of a warm-up into this event? Just give us a sense of what it's like, the vibe on the ground.
Well, it's a holiday here. Obviously, it's quiet. You know, I think that for players, it feels like, you know, a huge property. Your first impression here is wow, this is going to be a lot of work to get around here. The walk in and of itself is a tough task. You know, I think it's going to look a lot different to Lancaster last year, which was obviously packed with fans and on a more compact piece of property where, you know, it looked great on television. It's so big out here that the fans that are going to be here are going to be scattered out so far and wide that I think it's going to be hard to get that same vibe. And I just think that's just part of what comes with this property and where we are. So I think you're going to see a vast difference to last year, but players are excited for the challenge.
It's typical that we normally ask you about all of the top contenders, the number one player in the world like Nelly Korda. But you had a great story in Golf Week this morning, Bethan, about one of the more unheralded players in the field, Letta Lindley. Tell us about her.
Yeah, so one of the cool things about Letta, she actually will turn 53 on Sunday. So she is the reigning U.S. Senior Women's Open champion, and her goal is to become the first Senior Women's Open champion to make the cut, to have a tee time on her birthday, which I think is wonderful. And if anyone had a chance to watch her win at Fox Chapel, the thing that sticks out the most is her son Cole's reaction. She has two kids now in college, and Cole has become absolutely obsessed with golf, and just his raw emotion at seeing mom do this. You know, the Letta incredibly won her first title on the LPGA as a mother of two, which is an extraordinary feat in and of itself. She was playing her best golf traveling around with two kids in elementary school. So I give a lot of credit to Letta and her husband, Matt Plagman, who was on the bag for her entire LPGA career and will once again be on the bag this week. And I think she truly is inspiring for a lot of people who, you know, maybe see their dreams come true late in life.
Yeah, that's a great story. And Fox Chapel is a wonderful golf course not too far from Oakmont, of course, the host of the U.S. Men's Open. I want to talk about the golf course specifically, the test that Letta and others will face. 6,829 yards. A lot of talk about how long this golf course is going to play. 16 under one when Brooks won back in 2017. Your thought on what a winning score could potentially be this week?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be that low. There's already wind here, which, you know, that was the thing about 2017, right? The wind didn't show up. So it looks like on the forecast, while we will see rain, I think, a little bit midweek, we will see the wind, which is paramount here for this golf course to really show its teeth. So, you know, I definitely expect it to play long, which will be a challenge for a lot of players, you know, ball striking. It's certainly a second shot golf course, but you're also going to be able to navigate, you know, the surrounds and the green. It's the green complexes, you know, present some really, really unique challenges. So you have to have an all around game here.
Yanni Tseng back in the field in the U.S. Women's Open for the first time in 9 years, Bethan. You know, she'd won 5 majors by the age of 23, but it's been an awfully barren 12, 13 years since then. She just started working with Brady Riggs on her golf swing, made her way through the 36-hole qualifier into this field. Do you have any expectation that she can play her way back to some kind of relevance?
You know, I laughed a little bit when you mentioned Yanni's name because, number one, it's just such a delight to have her back. She's just so much fun to be around, and it's just mesmerizing to watch her putt left-handed now. Yanni is very blunt about the fact that she struggled with the yips in recent years and the fact that, you know, this was basically a mental shift. I've got to do something different here. And so, you know, Brady suggested she start putting left-handed, and pretty much immediately when she put it in a competition in Taiwan, she saw a difference and really hasn't looked back. So, you know, she actually, from a ball striking standpoint, still has it. The question, of course, is, you know, as the stakes get higher, you know, what will it look like on the greens? But, you know, for Yanni, her enthusiasm for the game, you know, she said to me, a lot of my good friends have retired. You know, she doesn't really know a lot of the players out here, and they're just getting to know her, which is kind of remarkable. But yeah, I mean, we look at Lydia Ko's resurgence, right? And we marvel at that. But what would it mean if Yanni were to come back after, you know, this incredible drought where she's, you know, hasn't even played on the LPGA, been off doing these long meditations where she doesn't speak for days, you know, trying to get back to old Yanni? I think it would be extraordinary.
Well, that'd be an incredible story. Well, she no doubt has heard about the world number one, Nelly Korda. A year ago, if I recall, she'd won 6 times ahead of the U.S. Women's Open, now looking for her first win of 2025. How is she handling it? We saw Scotty get a little bit frustrated before he knocked off a couple of wins, including the PGA. How is Nelly handling being winless so far this year?
Gracefully, I would say. You know, she knows that she's close. I'm sure she's internally, you know, certainly frustrated, but you know, I think the way that she bounced back at the Chevron after such a terrible start on Thursday was huge for Nelly. You know, she's coming into this major championship in control of her schedule. This is the only major on the LPGA calendar that does not have a pro-am round. So, you know, she got to play her full 18 holes today. And I think that was really what got her off on the wrong foot at Chevron was, you know, not teeing it up on Monday and then having rain force, you know, cancellation of some of the day on Wednesday and just really didn't feel settled going into the first round. So, you know, has had a couple of weeks off now, plenty of time to work on her game and to kind of reset coming into this week.
So many great storylines this week, and we look forward to hearing from you on Live from the U.S. Women's Open tomorrow. But Bethan, thanks for spending some of your holiday with us.
Thank you.